closest in equivalent,
yes,
right, to the word taqlid in Arabic, of course.
Yeah.
Would you talk about the translation of taqlid? Because you also use the word or the term following.
Yeah.
By taqlid, obviously, we don't mean that you imitate someone else,
yeah,
or you copy someone else, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
And what we mean is mostly limited to basically the jurisprudential verdicts, as you mentioned, right?
Yes. So, as you rightly mentioned, the word mimic or imitate is not
the right word.
It's not the right word.
Yes.
It's not appropriate to use these words when we talk about taqlid. Taqlid has actually a philosophy,
yes,
a reason which is very clear and very vivid. When we follow a mujtahid, we follow because we have no knowledge or no expertise,
yes,
no actually,
expertise, yes,
no technical actually awareness,
yes,
about the practical laws of Islam. So it's only the mujtahid or the faqih who is an expert of Islamic law, and of course he is the one who should be who advises about religious issues, about jurisprudential issues, and we should listen to his advice.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's what taqlid actually means.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IranRadio.ir. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program and sharing with our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the major concepts of jurisprudence, I mean taqlid. Well, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, you know, if we don't actually, you know, follow a mujtahid,
yeah,
or a religious authority, is there any other way planned out or devised by the religion for us? Is it available to a mukallaf or a duty-bound, like to, you know, practice some of the rituals in Islam?
Well, to be honest, taqlid is the easiest way, to practice Islam and to practice religion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are. It's not the only way,
mm-hmm,
because there are other ways to practice Islam.
Yeah.
So, taqlid is one of them. And of course, a person who engages in jurisprudential studies and finally becomes a mujtahid himself,
mm-hmm,
he does not need to follow another person.
Yes.
He's not a muqallid,
right,
and he's someone who acts upon his own understanding, upon according to his own knowledge and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, he's not supposed to act according to his own personal opinion.
Right.
He acts according to what he understands from the religious sources, okay? Any topic that he might have discovered or explored, he acts according to what he has understood.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there is also another way,
mm-hmm,
and that's called ihtiyat, okay?
Right.
Ihtiyat means to, of course, to see the different angles and all the dimensions,
mm-hmm,
and see which is more precautionary. Okay, and that's very difficult. Ihtiyat means, for example, I give you an example.
Right.
If you, for example, happen to miss your prayer during a journey, and then you come back home, mm-hmm. and again you miss your prayer at home when you back arrive in your own hometown.
I see.
Now, which prayer are you supposed to offer? Are you supposed to offer the shortened form of prayer because you missed, you did not offer your prayer during the journey,
mm-hmm.
or you have to offer the full prayer, the complete prayer? According to Ihtiyat, okay, you have to observe both full and qasr prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what precaution Ihtiyat means, okay?
Yes.
Because you missed the prayer during the journey and also when you arrived at home. But if you do not act according to Ihtiyat and you simply follow a mujtahid, the mujtahid will tell you mm-hmm. that, okay, if you offer the prayer in full, that's enough.
I see.
You're not going to exercise precaution and offer the same prayer, both as shortened form as well as full form.
That's why you meant taqlid is the easiest way, actually.
That's why I say that taqlid is the easiest way, because you trust the mujtahid
uh-huh.
who is knowledgeable, who is wise,
yes.
and who has the the necessary faculty and the capability to infer Islamic laws from its sources, i.e. mm-hmm. the Quran and the Sunnah and also the other religious sources.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abid. I have a relevant question, but we have to actually postpone it to after the break. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Before the break, Sheikh Javid, when you were talking about, taqlid being the easiest way of practicing Islam, you mentioned within your speech there are other ways, than taqlid. What are those ways? One of them you mentioned, ihtiyat, right?
One of them is to exercise precaution.
Yes.
Okay, ihtiyat is the most difficult way to
which
practice
is based
Islam.
On logic, I guess, right?
Yeah, it is logic, yes. It's the
like your logic or your, precaution, as you mentioned.
Yeah, precaution.
Or your intellect tells you, for example, to, as you mentioned in your example, to have to offer prayers for both of, for example, the missed prayers, whether the shortened one or the complete form,
yes.
right? So this is what the logic tells you.
The logic.
To cover both.
Yes.
At least one of them is going to be accepted,
right,
by God.
Yeah, one of them. Yeah, of course.
So, but taqlid, as you mentioned, trust the mujtahid or a learned, or the most learned religious scholar, and then you follow that particular individual.
Yes.
But what are the other ways?
The other way is to become a mujtahid yourself.
I see.
You know, because we have many mujtahid here and there, and especially in Islamic seminaries.
Mm-hmm.
And those mujtahids are not following any other scholars, okay? They act according to their own inferences, according to their own deductions,
knowledge,
okay? According to their own conclusions,
yes.
And that's also very difficult, because to become a mujtahid, it will take you, let's say, 20 years, if not more,
yes,
to become a mujtahid, and at the end of the day, you will cease to practice or follow another mujtahid. You will follow your own opinion concerning religious issues.
Yes.
So that's the second way. And of course, the easiest way, as I said, is taqlid.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay. I'm sure that, when you talk about taqlid or following, a religious scholar, you mean that in jurisprudential issues, right?
Yeah.
And in some of the, issues and problems you have related to the rituals, but not everything, not the tenets, not the pillars of Islam, right?
Yes.
Is that
course.
Correct?
You are right. Of course, the religious authorities have indicated in their beginning of their risala that it is not permissible to follow Islam in regards to the tenets and principles of faith,
mm-hmm.
and it's necessary to believe in the principles of faith based on your own insight and your own understanding. Mm-hmm. Okay, it is necessary that you develop this understanding over time. Of course, as a child, you might not have that understanding, but as you grow up and you consider and you study everything, then you will begin to understand that there should be one God.
Yes.
And that one God should be just.
Mm-hmm.
And then he should send a prophet. And then there should be some people as imams, infallible imams.
Yes.
Who should, after the prophet, guide the humanity with their teachings.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be unpicking the US President Donald Trump's claims about the future for Gaza. In our first report, Lydia Forever Chakra looks at what could be behind Trump's outlandish plan for the mass ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Donald Trump has put forth his plan to empty Gaza of Palestinians and pave the way for Greater Israel. While reports on his presidential campaign have focused largely on funding from the Adelson family, there was much more Zionist money involved in his election, which seems to have passed under the radar of commentators. Trump's campaign was also funded by Isaac Perlmutter and his wife. Perlmutter is the former chairman of Marvel Entertainment. He fought in the Israeli military, occupying the West Bank and Gaza. His family foundation also funds the Friends of the Israeli Occupation Forces, the ADL, and the Jewish Agency for Israel, as well as the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Perlmutter is also very close to Trump, and in his last presidency, was often referred to as shadow of head of military veteran affairs, due to his close advisory role. Another key Trump funder is the company Uline, which is headed by Richard Uline. This individual also funded the Accuracy in Media organization, which doxed pro-Palestinian students in the US and put their faces on trucks and billboards to try and intimidate them into silence. Another source of funds for his campaign was Crown Quest, which is headed by Tim Dunn, who is simultaneously chairman of the Christian Advisory Board of the Israel Allies Foundation. The Trump presidential run was also financially backed by Standard Industries, a project of David Millstone, who also heads the Tech Aviv Founders Club, which describes itself as a private global network of Israeli technology company founders and top-tier investors that harness our collective knowledge and networks to help each other build better companies. The organization works closely with Israeli intelligence figures like Nadav Zafrir, former commander of the infamous Signals Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. Trump was also funded by investment firm Andreessen Horowitz, which invests in Israeli companies. Andreessen Horowitz funded many Israeli ventures, like Wiz, founded by Asaf Rappaport, a former officer in the famed 8200 military unit. Andreessen Horowitz also funds Toka, an Israeli cyber defense startup, which features many Israeli war criminals and was founded by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Trump is clearly far more deeply entrenched in the Zionist movement than many thought. The next few years will change history.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller, who's widely regarded as the UK's preeminent scholarly critic of Israel. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University, and he's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Today's guest contributor is the American human rights lawyer and author, Dan Kovalik. His books cover human rights and US foreign policy, and his latest book, The Case for Palestine, was published last year. Welcome to the show. David, why do you think there's been so much focus on Adelson? I mean, when the rest of the funders are die-hard Zionists as well, aren't they?
Well, I mean, Trump is all the way in with Zionism. Almost all of his cabinet picks have been Zionists, and of course many of his funders are too. Adelson is important, though. I mean, we've got to remember that the 100 million, it's not an inconsequential amount. It's not the biggest amount he's had, but it's not inconsequential. And of course, it was the part of the price for that was the operations in the West Bank. And it's very, very clear that the condition of the money was that the annexation of the West Bank would be going ahead. So that is important. But let's also, of course, look at all the other funders. I mean, many funders outlined in the film there, people will never have heard of or never have realized that they were also directly funding President Trump. So, yeah, all the way through his administration, every single person who's been appointed or who's funding him is pro-Israel.
Makes a mockery of democracy, doesn't it? Are they kind of buying influence, aren't they?
Well, of course they are. I mean, the idea that there's democracy in America or in the UK is obviously preposterous, as there never has been or has not been for very, very many years now. So, yeah, we all only have two factions of the business party, two factions of the Zionist supporting parties, and that's what Western democracy is now.
Well, Dan, I mean, does Donald Trump have any redeeming qualities in your opinion?
Well, yes, of course he does. I mean, the fact that he's trying to make peace with Russia is huge. I didn't even realize till this morning, I was listening to a podcast, I didn't realize that Russia and the U.S. Don't even have ambassadors in each other's countries at the moment, you know, which I guess Trump's going to remedy. That's just insane, you know, that the U.S. wasn't talking to Russia really for 4 years under Biden. And Trump wants to do that. Trump wants to find a way not only to ratchet down the war in Ukraine, but to talk about weapons reductions, nuclear weapons reductions, and also general military spending reductions. All that's good. I mean, that's something, you know, any sane person should applaud.
Well, David, I mean, what do you make of the fallout over Donald Trump cutting funding to the U.S. Agency for International Development?
Well, it's been very, very interesting. Of course, the Democrats have been squealing very loud about this because many of their pet projects have been cut by this. Mm-hmm. And of course, what pet projects that is especially those liberal projects which are funded in order to undermine and subvert sovereign governments around the world. So these are regime change operations that the USAID was set up and came out of a process where the CIA was previously exposed as being involved in covert operations and covertly funding the Center for Cultural, the Congress for Cultural Freedom back in the 60s, and there was a Church Commission inquiry into it. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they went overt. So they started to fund a lot of their previous covert work overtly through the National Endowment for Democracy and through USAID, and that's how they fund many of their activities in regime change, all the way over all of Europe, West Asia, of Africa. And so when that's cut, the Democrats don't like it because, of course, the Democrats are aligned with some of the liberal ideas, especially the feminism, the LGBTQI plus and all that stuff, which is used to undermine Iran or Kyrgyzstan or wherever else it is, the old days. So we're moving away from overt operations and back into covert operations. So these things will still go on.
And, of course, many of those governments that they've overthrown have been democratically elected governments, aren't they? They're hardly kind of tyrannical regimes, aren't they? But Dan, I mean, surely Donald Trump's plan for Gaza is unworkable, isn't it?
Well, it's not only unworkable. That plan is immoral, it's illegal, And frankly, it's likely to start a regional war, in particular between Israel and Egypt and possibly Israel and Jordan. It's very dangerous, this plan to empty Gaza of all of its people, which is ethnic cleansing, of course. And really, it's genocidal because it's part of the overall genocidal plan, and to remove them to places like Egypt and Jordan and other places. Again, it's illegal, it's immoral, and yeah, it's unworkable. The people of Gaza are not going to leave. That's their homeland. The only way that that could happen is it through mass extermination and violence, which, you know, has to be opposed. So it's an insane plan. If it is a real plan, I don't know. Is it bluster? I don't know. But if it is a real plan, it's crazy.
Well, David, I mean, I suspect a lot of people won't know that some years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu prepared a list of major donors, didn't he? And included on that list was Donald Trump. I think you've done some research into that, haven't you? Just unpick that a little bit for us, will you?
Well, it was a list prepared for Netanyahu, yeah. And then the list was altered in his hand, where he added more people to the list, and he prioritized them, you know, people who are more likely, people who are less likely, who are going to give more, who are going to give less. Mm. Yes, of course, Trump was on the list, Rupert Murdoch was on the list, and a huge number, and these are two who are non-Jewish potential supporters, huge number of Jewish Zionist funders, including many of the people who have been discussed in the film a minute ago. All the great and the good of the Israeli billionaire class and the Zionist billionaire class, which of course makes up something like 10 or 20% of the billionaire class in general, although Jews are of course only 0.2% of the world's population. So yeah, this is a list which was drawn up back in the mid-2000s, and which it does indicate the way in which much of what happens in Palestine is actually funded from outside Palestine by Zionist funders. And that, again, people don't understand that. They think the Israel lobby is the Zionists coming over to the UK and the US and influencing policy, which of course they do, but actually much of the money for the genocide that's happening now is coming out from outside, from the UK and the US.
Right. Well, Dan, I mean, what do you expect for the West Bank then in the coming months?
Well, sadly, I don't expect good things to happen there. Bad things are happening right now. Mass expulsions of Palestinians, destruction of housing, killing of Palestinians, mass arrests. And sadly, I think that's the order of the day. I think that will continue into the foreseeable future, sadly.
Well, our next report highlights the extensive list of committed Zionists who contributed to Donald Trump's presidential election campaign fund.
Looking down the list of funders for Donald Trump's presidential campaign, it's very difficult to spot non-Zionist sources of funds. Even the donors who on the surface seem to be at least indifferent are actually hardcore Zionists when exposed to the most elementary level of investigation. For example, a key donor to his campaign was the Elliott Management Investment Firm. This organization is the brainchild and instrument of its president, Paul E. Singer. He has not only funded the Birthright Israel Project, but also the Israeli military and the Israel Independence Fund. He also is responsible for setting the Startup Nation Central Initiative alongside key Netanyahu loyalists. The stated purpose of the organization is to combat BDS by feeding big tech jobs into Israel, but also by feeding Israeli workers into big tech companies. It is through organizations like Startup Nation Central that you have a huge mass of former Israeli intelligence agents working inside Google today. Another low-profile source of Zionist funds for the Trump campaign came from Book Capital Enterprises, founded by Robert H. Book. He's described in his biography at Access Capital as a major philanthropist in support of Israel, and previously met Trump at the Alamainer Gala, held by the staunch Zionist website. Trump's campaign for re-election as president also received funds from the Primerica Insurance Company. The firm has a history of funding the Israeli spy agency, the ADL. The true extent of Trump's loyalty to Zionist expansion is yet to be fully revealed.
Now then, David, Pauli Singer was identified in that report as another key donor to Donald Trump. I mean, what do you know about him?
Well, this is yet another mega-rich Zionist American donor to Trump and to Zionist causes. He has a foundation, of course, and he gives money to the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, which does what it says on the tin, and to the ADL and to all sorts of other, to the Birthright Foundation, which tries to convince young Jews that they have a birthright to steal Palestinian land, which of course there is no such right. So that he's a carbon copy of many of them in some respects, but in other respects he's not. I mean, he's also involved with this Startup Nation Central thing, which is a really very interesting thing because it illustrates another aspect of the way in which Zionism operates. So people think there's the Israel lobby and they investigate and they try and pressure governments to change their policies. And that's true. But there's another aspect to what the Zionists do. And this Startup Nation thing is a key example. They try and encourage Israeli tech startups in Israel, yeah, and then to invest in the US and the UK and many others. There are hundreds of them involved in activity in the UK today. And so what that then does is it brings people from Unit 8200, the cyber surveillance intelligence agency of the Israeli state,
yeah,
into these tech companies. So you have tech companies, for example, in the US, having huge ranges of people from Israeli intelligence working in the higher echelons of Twitter, X as it's now called, and Google and all the other tech companies.
Yeah.
And you also have these tech companies investing directly in Israel so that they're more and more invested in Zionism. So that's another way in which Zionism infiltrates,
yes,
the social media companies and the high-tech industry,
yes,
which people don't really understand, I don't think.
No, insidious. Well, Dan, I mean, it seems Donald Trump's attempting to twist the arms of the Arab states, doesn't it? I mean, how do you think that's going to go?
Well, he can do it to some extent, of course, using the power of the purse, because a lot of these states are dependent on the U.S. and, of course, also by threatening them with military force. But he can only do it to some extent. I think, again, this plan, if it is a plan, to ethnically cleanse all of Gaza and remove the people there to other countries, that will be resisted. Trump will not be able to bully countries into that, because if they go along with it, any Arab country that goes along with it risks their government collapsing or being overthrown. So out of just sheer self-preservation, the Arab states are not going to go along with that.
Well, David, Saudi Arabia seems to have come out against Trump's plan, don't they? I mean, do you buy that?
Well, I do buy it. I mean, I think that what you see with Donald Trump, as you can probably tell by just listening to him for 30 seconds, is that he just says any old nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, he might express his desires or his wishes, but it's not really properly thought out. And you could see when it was happening that Netanyahu was sitting looking down, smirking, mm-hmm, at what was being said, as if it was his dreams come true.
Yes,
you know?
Indeed.
But of course it was not going to happen, and it didn't happen. He said, unless all the hostages are released by 12 noon on Saturday, Gaza would be destroyed. Well, that wasn't going to happen. It didn't happen. And in fact, the Israelis had to back down. Hamas said, right, you'll have no more hostages.
Yeah.
And the Israelis had to back down and send in more aid. Of course, they're still prevaricating.
Yeah.
But that's the only reason that the hostages were released, was because the Israelis backed down, not because of the threat from Trump. Trump, of course, ends up looking very, very stupid. Anyone who thinks that this is a serious guy after that debacle of the last couple of weeks, it's a mistake. So the Saudis are probably engaged in a posturing situation. The Saudis are not the supporters of the Palestinian people. They're traitors to the Palestinian people, just like the UAE is as well. And of course, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, has this massive investment with the Saudis, and they're talking about beachfront properties and all of that. All of that is in motion behind this. But I do think that the Saudis were being critical in a way which is genuine.
Yes. Well, certainly the Saudi population, I'm sure, will be absolutely on the side of the Palestinian people, as virtually everybody is right across ordinary people, that is, right across the world. But, well, Dan, what kind of position is the UAE likely to take on all this then, do you think?
I think they'll go along with the other Arab states in opposing this. Again, I just don't think any self-respecting country in the Arab or Muslim world can go along with this project. It goes against everything that they've stood for decades.
Well, David, I know you've done a lot of research on the UAE and its long-standing links to the Zionist movement, haven't you? It might be helpful if you just kind of summarise what you discovered.
So the UAE has been the key ally of the Zionist entity in West Asia, the West Asian region. It's been the key normaliser. It has taken the Saudis along with it. The Saudis have followed the leadership of the UAE. Of course, the Saudis have pretended not to be normalising at the same time as they were covertly normalising. And, of course, the UAE has invested heavily in Zionist propaganda groups in the US, the Foundation for Defence of Democracies, for example, which is more or less a Likudnik think tank. Mm. And, of course, they have been at the forefront of spreading Islamophobia across the US and Europe, raising worries about the Muslim Brotherhood and all this sort of stuff, which led to an inquiry in the UK into the Muslim Brotherhood, ordered by David Cameron, the Prime Minister. And at the same time as they're worrying about this and saying that there's all these problems with radical Muslims, they're also supporting the collapse of the Bashar al-Assad government in Syria, and in fact helping to bring al-Qaeda into government in Syria. So it's a contradictory position, but it's very, very pro-Zionist.
Right, very interesting. Well, Dan, how do you think the resistance in the region then is going to respond to Trump's plan?
Yes, I think if the U.S. and Israel try to carry out the plan of ethnically cleansing Gaza, I believe the resistance will fight very hard against that. I think Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Yemen will all engage in very direct measures against Israel. And I think they'll be joined by other countries. I think most likely Egypt, for example. In which case, I think the very preservation of Israel, it would be in question. I think that Israel would not be able to withstand that type of coordinated assault. Israel already has terrible economic problems. It has demographic problems. It's lost a lot of residents since October 7th who will never return. It's lost tens of thousands of businesses. It's lost many troops either to being wounded or being killed. The morale of the Israeli military is very, very low. So I don't think it can withstand what the resistance is ready to do if it moves forward with this plan of ethnic cleansing in Gaza. But I think any, you know, people in the West and like myself living in countries like the U.S. have to also join in resisting any plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza, or the West Bank, for that matter, or South Lebanon, which is happening as we speak. I just saw Israel just extended a wall into South Lebanon, you know, separating Lebanese now, some into Lebanon and some into occupied Palestine. All these things have to be resisted. This is against international law. It's immoral. And we have an obligation to raise our voices against it.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. So a special thank you to our guest, Dan Kovalik. And, of course, thanks to our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
For the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah's martyred leader, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, Palestine was not a regional conflict, but rather the soul of humanity's struggle. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Hezbollah's martyred leader Seyed Hassan Nasrallah was laid to rest on Sunday, 23rd of February, in the presence of millions of his admirers who have flocked to Beirut to attend his historic funeral. While he's not physically around anymore, his death does not mean the end of his mission. His martyrdom on 28th of September last year marked an eruption of a volcanic force that will reshape history and inspire future generations of resistance fighters and justice seekers. His pure blood, like that of all martyrs of the resistance front, will fuel the unquenchable fire of justice, the struggle against oppression, and the unyielding march towards freedom of Palestine. His burial ceremony transcended grief. It was a global phenomenon of defiance, echoing from Lebanon's valleys to Gaza's rubble-strewn streets, from Yemen's rugged mountains to every corner where the oppressed rise against Western imperialism and Zionism. The martyred leader of the Islamic resistance movement in Lebanon stood unshaken, while others in the Arab world faltered. He forged not merely an organization, but a movement whose legacy will grow bigger and brighter. His ideology rejected colonial humiliation, declaring sovereignty non-negotiable and dignity inviolable. He was not a politician but an institution that reshaped the equations of power in West Asia region and strengthened the resistance front against the Zionist regime. His strength was not inherited. It was formed in the crucible of wars, seizures, assassinations, and relentless psychological warfare against the resistance front. Hezbollah, born under the shadow of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, led by the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, became a force to be reckoned with under his leadership. It became a parallel society, a fortress of dignity, shielding the oppressed, defying occupiers, and rewriting the rules of resistance. We continue with Press TV's coverage of this story. Seyed Hassan Nasrallah's speeches were not mere addresses, but powerful salvos aimed at the enemy. In his iconic spider's web speech, he dismantled the myth of Israeli invincibility with a single phrase, "Israel is weaker than a spider's web." These words shattered decades of Zionist propaganda, exposing the fragility of their so-called military might. Distilling Hezbollah's creed into three immutable principles, dignity, resistance, and defiance, he declared, "We are a people who will not be humiliated." Seyed Hassan Nasrallah's leadership was inseparable from Imam Khomeini's revolutionary theology, a doctrine where faith is action, martyrdom is victory, and resistance is divine. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, sharpened this vision, declaring, "The path to Al-Quds is paved with resistance." Together, they transformed faith into a blueprint for revolution, merging spirituality with resistance. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's unbreakable bond with Haj Qasem Soleimani, Iran's anti-terrorism commander, epitomized this creed. Their alliance was no diplomatic formality, but a blood oath, forged in the heat of battle for Palestine's liberation. Seyed Hassan Nasrallah urged his followers in his final remarks. He said, "Follow Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It was a sacred pledge to preserve and protect the revolution, led by Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei's heartfelt eulogy for Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, calling him my brother and my pride, was also no political gesture. It was a covenant, a vow that the axis of resistance would bend to no empire and to no threat and no compromise. It was a beautiful tribute to what the martyred Hezbollah leader did for the resistance front for decades. He walked the path of Karbala, where Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny left a legacy. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, Imam Hussein stood alone, but his cry shook empires. Martyrdom is not death, it is immortality. This philosophy materialized in 2000 when Hezbollah expelled Israeli occupation forces from southern Lebanon, marking the Arab world's first military victory over the Israeli regime. In 2006, during Israel's 33-day war, Hezbollah's resilience stunned the world. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah turned martyrdom into a weapon, vowing, every drop of blood writes Zionism's obituary. Website of Iran's English-language newspaper Kayhan has also covered this story and tells us more. For Hezbollah's martyred leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Palestine was not a regional conflict, but rather it was the soul of humanity's struggle. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah proclaimed, we fight not for the land, but for justice. Under Ayatollah Khamenei's guidance, Hezbollah's arms, intelligence networks, and alliances became lifelines for Palestine resistance. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, to abandon Palestine is to surrender the future. Nasrallah was no ordinary leader. He was a master strategist who could outsmart and outpower the enemy despite limited resources. He outmaneuvered empires with his sharp wit and wisdom, exposing Zionism's fatal flaw, arrogance. He once said, they study our weapons, but they fear our will. He warned, political Islam withers when it trades dignity for power. Hezbollah thrived because it adhered to Imam Khomeini's path, the path of resistance, construction, and never compromise. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's martyrdom is not an epilogue, it is a prologue. As Zubur al-Mughawamah notes in his book, the blood of the righteous does not vanish. It courses through history's veins, breathing life into the struggle. The axis of resistance is no mere alliance, but a hurricane, uprooting collaborators and cowards from Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's shadow looms. Ayatollah Khamenei reminded us that the road to liberation is paved with martyrs. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's blood now fuels a new generation. Hamas in Gaza hurling Molotov, fighters in Syria reclaiming villages, and students in Tehran chanting death to America. His life screamed one truth, resistance is eternal. His legacy is not stone memorials, but rage that burns in every child who throws a stone, every mother who defies checkpoints, every fighter who chants death to Israel. The great revolution that Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, started, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei continued, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah armed, cannot be stopped. As Zionism trembles and empires decay, his voice thunders across time. The spider's web collapses, the dawn rises. The martyrs are watching, the fight goes on, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's flame will never die.
Thank you. On April 18, 1943, the Japanese commander, Admiral Yamamoto, leaves the Rabaul base in New Guinea and heads to the Solomon Islands. This is the Admiral's last flight. In the middle of the way, 16 American fighters appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. As a result of the gunfire, the wing of the plane comes apart and the Admiral's plane crashes into the jungle. The question was, where did the planes come from? How did Yamamoto's flight path become known? A great discovery of the 19th century was the telegraph, which quickly spread throughout the world. In 1941, the German U-boat submarines appear dangerously. The United Kingdom calls on the U.S. 4 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Atlantic Declaration is issued. The U.S. and the United Kingdom unite. In 1943, the top secret Brusa Agreement is signed to spy on German communications exclusively between the United States and the United Kingdom. Eavesdropping networks are interconnected. Thus, encryption, penetration, and code breaking take on more serious form. Newspapers scare people and pressure politicians. Eisenhower thinks about bridging the gap and speaks of the need to establish a base. 4 days later, Secretary of Defense Neil McElroy speaks in Congress about the formation of an organization that will be responsible for building missiles and carrying out space projects to ward off the emerging danger. This organization is called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. This organization begins to operate under the management of Johnson from General Electric. Roy Johnson has become the director of ARPA while leaving his job as an executive assistant and a salary of $160,000 to work at ARPA. The budget of $520 million for ARPA is approved. Identifying devices on the network was an important issue that was resolved with IP. Each system had a unique number in order to maintain technical aspects and comply with the Department of Defense policies. ICANN was formed. ICANN, headquartered in California, became the name and number assigner of systems on the internet. These identifiers included domain names, IP addresses, and many other parameters. Interestingly, the U.S. government still has the privilege of verifying domain names on the internet. It also controls the purchase and sale of domains. With Echelon, privacy was lost forever. Shamrock, the Minaret program, the Counterintelligence program, and the Chaos program. The latter was a special program of the CIA and FBI to discredit the opposition, and it was different from the program that was specifically designed to spy on students. Echelon had been picked and chosen and had a specific plan to spy on every protest in the Washington, D.C. area. Mike Frost, who was responsible for installing spy equipment inside the embassies, made the revelation. The leaks reached the embassy buildings. He said that sophisticated receivers and processors were secretly transported to the embassies in diplomatic packages and bags, and, after being installed, were used for espionage.
See that structure at the top that looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top? I watched them build that. I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his words. The equipment installed in the American Embassy in Geneva and the American Embassy in Berlin was also of the same type. This part of Echelon was called the stateroom, the stateroom. Echelon services were getting better and better, and Mike Frost had more to confess. Echelon had also been used to spy on two members of the British cabinet by order of Margaret Thatcher. Echelon's footprint was also seen at Princess Diana's palace and in the Mossad's revenge operation for the Munich incident. In 2000, CIA Director James Woolsey confirmed that Echelon was also involved in industrial and commercial espionage for financial reasons. This led to the massive Boeing contracts and unemployment for European companies and professionals. America was also stealing European jobs. A delegation from the European Union traveled to Washington, but all meetings were canceled by the United States, forcing the committee to end its trip early. The U.S. did not respond to the demands.
Come on, fire!
On September 11, 2001, a strange incident occurred. Two planes crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was shocked and emotional. No one saw the engineered collapse of the towers. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators had to be caught and punished. These events led to the public being monitored along with the terrorists. Echelon's abuses were forgotten, and Echelon was tasked with fighting terrorism against all odds. The war on terror began. At a later time, the United States tried to form a coalition to attack Iraq. Until then, Western officials had considered Echelon's features and services insignificant and minor, but when Colin Powell revealed the conversations of Baathist commanders about hiding chemical weapons to convince members of the Security Council to attack Iraq, Echelon's incredible capabilities in recording conversations were revealed. Conversations were converted into text. Echelon was more than what was stated. In 2003, the United States attacked Iraq, and murder and killing increased subsequently. Julian Assange started making disclosures. After launching WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of leakers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, the young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked for the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton, a security contractor for the Department of Defense, made a major disclosure during an interview. The NSA had been conducting widespread spying on everything, even social media. The internet is not safe.
Targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the intelligence cooperation of Western countries during the Cold War contained the most hidden secrets of the Western world. Protect American Act of 2007 had led to the creation of a secret program. A program to collect two types of data, metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There really was a conspiracy. Google, which was the source for many people to search, watch movies and send emails, was at the heart of the PRISM. All information and activities of users on the internet were recorded, and the NSA had amazingly direct access to the data of Google and other internet giants such as Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small businesses. It stored them easily. The organization had worked magic. The encryption software itself had become a spying agent. For example, journalists used the Tor software to hide their identities. They were supposed to use Tor to prevent them from being tracked and their identities from being revealed. But that was not the case. That was a big lie, in fact. Everything was under the watchful eye of the organization. Only 10% of the internet was available to ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was controlled by the NSA. Snowden also disclosed Bull Run and XKey Score. These programs were used to encrypt online communications and data, and the amount allocated for them was $800 million. The situation became critical, and the matter went to the Senate. In the Senate hearing, James Clapper was called to account. He was asked if the NSA had recorded data or information from the American people. Clapper said no. Perjury led to Clapper's dismissal. In the UK, the situation was worse. Although the British spy agency had a system that detected encrypted communications inside cable networks, it was desperately seeking to penetrate Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their spy program was Tempora, which began in 2008 and went into operation in 2011. Another program was called Edgehill. These programs had a strange feature. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques, and for example, Edgehill, which cost over $250 million a year, cracked email passwords, bank documents, and medical records, penetrated VPNs and secure layers, and was in the process of penetrating fourth-generation smartphones. This program was intentionally damaging the equipment. It was really dangerous software. Why was the equipment, though, so vulnerable? After designing and manufacturing the product, companies were required by law to send their products to the organization for regulatory testing in accordance with U.S. legal requirements. By making changes to the design, the NSA and CIA made the equipment sent by the companies traceable and even turned it into a spy tool. The NSA was also planning to spy via hubs and free Wi-Fi-like routers. Verizon's phone software, with 100 million customers, was also used for spying. The documents show that the agency had also penetrated international standards that rely on encryption systems and introduce weaknesses in security standards. Snowden's death blow was at the concept of standards in information technology. The agency had secretly worked to get its version into a security standard proposal issued by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, approved for use worldwide in 2006. The standard also served the NSA. It was as if the spy race was heating up. The FBI and CIA were aware of the weaknesses of intelligence systems, but they didn't tell anyone because of espionage and exploited these vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to avenge 9/11 began with extensive espionage. The main platform for espionage was the internet, but this was not all of the revenge's plan. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, "You are either with us or against us," led to the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. The groundwork was laid for international intranets. The Eyes Alliance was formed. 9 Eyes, 14 Eyes, and 40 Eyes. Information was classified and was only provided with guarantees and in a limited manner. The game had begun. After a year of effort, a 27-terabyte database was created by the Bagram Airfield, which stored regional information. Polish soldiers who were sent to Afghanistan went to difficult and remote places that Americans would not go. In return for the favor, they received an interceptor from the United States and tried to help the U.S. quite a bit.